This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us Portland writer and therapist Philip Kenny. He is a practicing psychotherapist who did his postgraduate work in British Object Relations at the Washington, D.C. School of Psychiatry. He has taught self-psychology as part of his private practice. A longtime meditator and poet, Mr. Kenny is the author of the novel Radiance and a collection of poetry, Where Roses Bloom. He strives to bring together the worlds of psychology, creativity, and spirituality in his work and is the author of a new book on those subjects entitled The Writer's Crucible, Meditations on Emotion, Being, and Creativity. You can find out more about Philip at www.philip-kenney.com. Welcome to the program, Philip.
Well, thanks, Sheila.
I am really looking forward to talking to you about, among other things, object relations and self-psychology, and of course, writing, and how you meld those two things together in your own writing practice and in your help with other people. So I'm going to back up, though, to ask, when did you start writing, and where along the line did it occur to you to write a book for writers about the emotions involved in being creative?
I started writing at a late age, about 45. Most of my friends started when they were little and could pick up a crayon and started telling stories. But my writing life began quite unusually at the age of 45. It really began with anxiety and astonishment. It was the early 90s. I had been therapist for 15 years. The Prozac revolution was upon us. Everyone was talking about the remarkable antidepressant Prozac. I decided after years of my own struggles with melancholy and some depression to give it a try, allegedly to see what my patients were experiencing, but more secretively, hoping that it would cure me of my longtime melancholy. So I took Prozac for about 8 weeks. I absolutely hated it. It wasn't for me. I quit cold turkey, which is a bad idea. Your listeners should know that I'll never quit an SSRI cold turkey. The next 2 weeks after I quit were just some of the worst of my life. The hangover was terrible. I felt despairing, etc. And then the astonishing thing happened. I woke up on a brilliant, sunny Saturday morning with a terrible anxiety attack going. This was in the spring, and I thought, oh, great, no more depression, high anxiety, what's next? As I stewed in my bed, all of a sudden I discovered that attached to the anxiety was a poem, a 20-line poem completely composed. Somehow or another, I had the presence of mind to write it down. As I wrote it down, I realized, hey, I'm not anxious, I'm not depressed. This is enlivening. That was the beginning of my writing. Luckily, fortunately, I stumbled upon William Stafford's work shortly thereafter and gave me a couple of tips that sent me on my way of, you know, write a poem every morning. And for the threads, the little threads that come up in consciousness and go with those. That was liberating for me. I wrote a poem every day for 10 years.
Wow.
Most of them were as bad as the first one. The first one was terrible, but it was the opening.
I want to say that while you speak about the anxiety and finding a poem attached to it, I'm remembering something said by a famous poet. Can't remember who it was, but I'm sure lots of poets will agree that poets live at the edge of their nerves or the end of their nerves. And if we're sensitive beings, and then we find that we can express it, even if it's not the best poem in the world, by writing poetry, I like that you use the word exhilarating, that that's the opposite side of it, that we find a way to say the unsayable, and it relieves some of the anxiety. Thank you for that story. It's a really personal story that I appreciate hearing, and especially that poetry was a salve. You learned a lot, it sounds like, by experiencing your own depression and anxiety and cure the writing. You wrote a poem a day for 10 years. When in there did you start writing The Writer's Crucible?
Not till later. I wrote the poetry for a long time, and I'm not a great poet, so it eventually kind of petered out. And then when I turned 60, or approaching my 60th birthday, I made a list of things that I was sure I could not do. Number one was playing the piano, which I was right about. My left hand's barely connected to neurology. And the second one was writing a novel. I was absolutely sure I couldn't write a novel, mostly because I was quite certain I couldn't write dialogue. But I started out And lo and behold, 6 months later, I wrote the end to a 93,000-word manuscript, largely because somewhere along the line, I realized, well, this is ridiculous. I sit with people all day and immersed in dialogue.
That's
of course,
right.
I can read dialogue, but it was a leftover psychological construct from my relationship with my dad, which was quite strained, and he's a very reticent man. Lots of moments of awkward silence. That got me through that, and that's when I really felt like I became a writer. I took to blogging to try to push the novel, but my blogs were ridiculous. I found myself writing 2,000-word-long blogs. So, but that got me, I realized, God, I love to write essays.
Uh-huh.
That's the closest I can come to thinking how I began to write the Writer's Crucible, other than, you know, I work with artists and writers all the time and listen to their struggles, and I know my own struggles. And
I want to say that you use the word ridiculous in a funny way. I mean, to be able to laugh at ourselves is really important, rather than to say, oh, we're a terrible writer. You say the poems were bad, but you sort of shrug it off. And you say, I didn't think I could write dialogue, but I found out that I could. Then you start writing blog posts and you find you have a lot to say, maybe more than a blog can handle. So I like listening to that. And I also love the titles of your chapters in your book, The Writer's Crucible. You have prologue, a short story. Then one is called The Project. The next chapter is You Are a Poem. The theater of the mind, the materials, novel and ideas and characters. Just thumbing through the book and reading those chapter titles makes me want to read what you have to say. Because it also calls The Writer's Crucible, and you obviously have been in the heat and listened to other people who are in the heat. Can you give us a description of the chapters? Very brief, because we want to get to hearing from you on some of the excerpts.
Well, thank you. It means a lot to me to hear you say that, because I frankly love those titles, and I didn't want the book to be clinical or academic, and so I thought these were simple chapter headings, recognizable and easily demystified some of the process, and were also evocative metaphors for both the writing process and the dynamics of the inner self. So there's titles like The Chair, which is about support, and The Desk, dependency, The Theater of the Mind, which is about the psychological complexity of our conscious and unconscious minds, and The Curtain, and all sorts of things that basically go round and round with the basic themes of the book, which is we are both resilient and fragile, but many of us have a persistent negative narrative, self-narrative, that we aren't good enough, which turns out to be utterly false. It's terribly convincing at times.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
One of the things that you do so skillfully in the book is you weave together moments of personal insight, and you've just given us one in your story about waking up on that beautiful sunny day with a poem attached to anxiety. So you have moments of personal insight woven in with the wisdom practices of many religions, stories from those religions, and then your own experience of writing. And I imagine, of course, some of that experience is the experience of listening to other people talk about their writing. One of my very favorite examples of this weaving starts on page 50 of your book. And I've asked if you would read that part, because I think it would be of benefit to so many of us.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I'm happy to. I did edit it down a little because the pages you identified was a little too long for our time frame.
I know. So I wish we had longer. But thank you.
Yeah, me too. So I'm starting at the middle of page 51. There are dark days and dark nights of the soul. But I have found that there is a force stronger than my bleakest hours, something that keeps persisting and calling my name. A few years ago, I dug up some ground in the backyard in preparation for making a foundation for a new deck. I dug down 4 inches and was surprised to find a layer of black plastic buried there. When I pulled up the plastic, I discovered a cluster of crocuses in full bloom, looking up at me. It was one of those unforgettable moments when not only is the sight so unexpectedly beautiful, but the mind is so taken aback that it stops in its tracks for an instant, and the presence of life flashes with a brilliance typically lost to the senses. I will always remember that moment as an epiphany of sorts, the flash of insight at the realization of a Zen koan, a revelation available to an ordinary person in an ordinary time and place. It gave me real confidence in a power much greater than ourselves and our defenses, a power that just keeps coming, that won't be deterred or defeated, one that has been streaming for millions upon millions of years. That same creative insistence that compels you to pick up your pencil or paintbrush and join in the audacious gamble of creativity. Those tender baby crocuses lay on their sides under dirt and plastic, their stems anemic, a pale ghostly white. Those same stems were too long, distorted by the long stretch of yearning for air and light. But the petals, the dear happy petals that greeted my eyes, were somehow impossibly of the fresh lavender, buttery yellow, and royal purple that we find each year popping their heads up above the surface of a late snowfall. Improbable life, blossoming despite all odds. And though I lose myself as regularly as the next person, I have confidence and find repeatedly that the force returns, that it can't be entirely shut down. That even in concentration camps, Jewish prisoners were making art. That even in cold, damp caves 50,000 years ago, Neanderthals were making art. That even in today's penitentiaries, prisoners are making art. I believe the mystery of that impulse, the headwaters of that unfathomable streaming that is creative life, reaches out for us from the untouchable depths of existence and will not be denied. And isn't that stream, that flow of experience, and that quiet center of knowing, like good verse, trembling with all kinds of unexpected arrivals and departures? Doesn't it thrive within a field of spaciousness that says yes, yes, and yes again? Doesn't it move like a great lyrical poem from the known to the unknown and back? I know you have experienced this inner self. It can't be entirely shut down. My earliest memory of being really awake is of running home in the dark and marveling, as a little boy, and marveling as my body slowly disappeared and I became one with breathing. Soon, even breathing fell away, and there I was, an aware being, residing within the activity of the world and my body. I didn't find the lightness of being unbearable. I found it delicious. Have you experienced this same state as an adult when overcome by a particularly arresting piece of art, or during the precious intimacy of lovemaking, or when encountering something staggeringly beautiful in the natural world? It sometimes happens looking into the eyes of an infant. I think it happens more often than we recognize. In any event, there's much of the same phenomenon, whether it's that first bite of ice cream or the first sip of beer on a summer day. What happens? The mind stops. And when it stops, even for an instant, the spacious well of being is revealed. Your deepest, most intimate you opens in all its fullness.
Thank you.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, Sheila is talking with Portland author Philip Kenny about how spirituality informs creativity and creativity informs spirituality.
Everybody needs to unlock the creative self in order to experience this kind of intimacy with themselves and with the world. How has your experience of noticing it and treasuring it, where does that lead you in terms of helping others find it in themselves? I know it's a lot to ask because we're not in a therapy session. That writing you just read certainly identifies it and makes me treasure every sensuous moment that I can take in the world through my senses. Is that a hard thing to do for people who come in with troubles?
Well, it's a very hard thing to do with people who come in with troubles, many of whom have a certain degree of trauma in their background. So many people are afraid to feel and afraid to open up their senses because they've experienced such terrible things. So it takes quite a while to work through some of those leftover emotions and sensations to allow them to help them to trust in their own sensual experience, in any experience for that part.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask if you encourage them to write.
Sometimes, often. It just depends on where they are in treatment, what stage they're in, and whether they have an enjoyment of that or an interest in it. Many people I've worked with artists who I encourage to paint their emotions, and that's been quite opening. The thing I've found is that The therapy and the writing feel seamless to me. They're very much on the same track. The way I work, I begin both with stillness and silence, with a radical honesty, really asking of myself and asking of others to be honest with their experience and with themselves. J.D. Salinger said it took him an hour of writing every morning to be honest with himself. And then James Baldwin, who I've been reading a lot again lately, said the task of an author is really to know themselves, and that there's a big part of us, and this is true for therapy too, that we don't want to know who we are. We don't want to know what we really feel and think. And so there's, I think, in writing and in therapy, a process of working with that resistance and getting to what's really at the heart that we have to say.
Right. You know, a lot of writing teachers will say, or writers will say, when you feel resistant as you're writing, that's the place you need to delve in and write. That feeling of resistance is something to be looked into. All of that said, you read from one of my very favorite passages in the book, but you must have some favorite chapters based on what other readers and clients may have said to you about the information you're sharing. Did you have another excerpt?
I do. This has been a great exercise for me because I wrote the book a while ago, and even though I'm teaching workshops on it, it helped me refresh it and remember some of the chapters I like so much. And people like the chapter, The Reader, and they like the chapter on stage and the section on You Are a Poem. I'm going to read a chapter. It's the first chapter of the section called Materials. And I just kind of like these a lot because they are just common things that in the book, I pick these chapter headings as metaphors. Like I said, I'm going to read the first chapter of the Materials section called The Pencil. It's a great metaphor, I think, for humility and whatever else you might find in it. It starts out with a character, Nasruddin, who's littered throughout the book. He's a character, if you've ever read Coleman Barks or heard him talk about translations of Rumi, Nasruddin is this Sufi character from the Middle Ages who he's sort of the Yogi Berra of spiritual characters and the fool on the hill. There's always little vignettes that he gets into that expose the folly of the human mind and striving. So this one starts out with Nasruddin. Nasruddin is sitting at a temple with his feet up on the altar. A priest enters and says, "Nasruddin, this is a holy place. Take your feet off the altar." Nasruddin turns and says to the priest, "But where shall I put them?" "Indeed, where? Where can you place your feet that isn't holy, that isn't sacred ground? What is precious to a writer? Is it sacred? What can we touch that isn't fully endowed with the spirit of our vision and work? Is it this skinny little pencil or this wrinkled piece of lined paper? Is it this gnarled old writing table or the creaking chair I'm sitting on? Aren't all these things precious to our daily encounter with the agony and the ecstasy? And what is art up to if it isn't taking the ordinary stuff of life and presenting it in such a way as to reveal the radiant beauty inherent in objects? C.K. Williams, one of my favorite poets, refers to the poet's difficult and risky task as that of, quote, informing the ordinary with the transcendent. If the world is precious, if it is sacred ground, Nasruddin is right. What can we touch that is not holy? If the act of writing and being visited by the creative spirit is not a sacred relationship, I don't know what is. I grew up in Ohio in the 50s when the only thing precious was security. Okay, maybe the ranch house was pretty special and the new black and white TV. I suppose I could throw in mom and apple pie. By the mid-60s, the crack in the cosmic egg was breaking wide open and the doors of perception followed, revealing a world of enchantment waiting to be discovered and adored. And did we ever? Suddenly, everything was precious. Even the most ordinary and insignificant of the lot. The beauty of writing for me is in the transformation of ordinary reality into what I think of as sacred. Actually, it's not a transformation, but an illumination by way of holding what is common in the light of art. It is what makes the mundane reveal its radiance, and what makes the ordinary sing. Take, for example, the pencil, the ubiquitous number 2 yellow pencil. I remember coveting my pencils as a kid. I would line them up in neat little rows and sharpen them one at a time until the lead was just right, pointed but not brittle. Even the wood shavings sliding out from the tiny pencil sharpener, even these ribbons of skin seemed important and kind of beautiful. They had a pleasant scent that made them feel alive somehow. The pencil is such a humble object, so simple and uncomplicated. And yet think of Tolstoy writing War and Peace. How many pencils do you think he went through in preparing his masterpiece? Talk about writer's cramp. Imagine him making the lead point with his carving knife. Can't you see that big Russian hand picking up his pencil, snuggling it between index finger and thumb, and beginning to write the first sentence of the day? In the literary world, the printing press and other advances in technology get most of the glory, but really, where would we be without the pencil? Even though you probably write with a computer, go now and pick up a pencil. Hold it in your hand gently. Feel the wood, the octagonal beveling balanced in your hand. Doesn't it feel just right? Light, but solid. Faithful and obedient to your needs as a good dog. Say thank you and turn it between your fingers. Isn't it fine? Really look at it and appreciate what it is and think of all your ancestors of the written word holding a pencil just like yours and preparing to write those precious letters on the tablet. Take a long look at the lead point. This is where the magic happens. The point touches the paper and voila, the paper is no longer empty. Little baby marks begin to appear, curves and slants, dots and dashes. An alphabet, letters lining up to make words, words collecting to make sentences, molecules of thought. And on it goes, with your own hand, your signature, your singular handwriting appears. When lead meets paper, you show up. You make your point. And we hope what shows up is your very own authentic voice.
Thank you. I like how you describe the pencil as just so simple. And that's, I think, one of the great tricks of really being able to write from your authentic self is simplicity. Like the simple idea that putting your feet on a sacred place isn't wrong because every place is sacred. That's a simple idea that's gotten quite complicated in our world. Yeah. And to back to the pencil, which I might adopt as my new mantra, back to the pencil. So thank you. You've really shown us what it means to slow down and observe and connect through our observation. I love the little boy who enjoyed sharpening his pencils. And it made me remember how much I liked being able to get up from my desk at school and go to the non-electric pencil sharpener.
Oh, yeah.
And turn that crank, and how much fun that was.
Even the sound of it was sort of melodious in a strange way.
Yeah, and it was liberating to be able to get up and do that.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
And just like our writing is. It's beautiful. And I've always felt that writing is a form of prayer, and I think that's connected to what you're saying about the authentic self showing up. That's what puts us right with the world. And it's very rewarding to have heard you read from the book. I want to repeat the title of it, The Writer's Crucible, by Philip Kenny, and you can find him at philip-kenny, K-E-N-N-E-Y.com. And again, the Philip only has one L, which I've had to learn to do when I write your name. We have just a few minutes before we have to end. I'd like to ask you what you're working on now.
Well, quite a bit. I really love to write essays, so I just sent off a couple. I wrote an essay that combines a lot of these ideas called On Disappearing into Joy. And I've been completely taken over by the reading of Richard Powers' novel, The Overstory.
Oh, yes.
And have you heard of it?
I have, and isn't he a Portland writer?
No, but he won the Pulitzer just recently, and it's an amazing epic of a book. I think it's a Moby Dick of our time, and really moves me. It's about trees and so many things. So I've been writing haikus to go with photos I've taken of the trees in our nearby park. And that's fun. I just kind of do that as a warm-up, and it's really been delightful. But I'm really waiting till tax season is over, and I have some coursework to take for my license renewal, to go back to a novel I ditched about 5 years ago that my best friend didn't like and my editor thought needed a paleo diet of 50,000 words. I think I have an idea where to go with it now. I'm really excited to get back to working on that.
Uh-huh. Well, I think your experience with haiku will help you with that diet, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Yes. That sounds exciting.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. Very encouraging.
I very much like the idea that while your mind is on taxes and renewing a license and all the work that takes, you're able to find a medium that works, the photo essays of trees and haiku. And I think that's something that's very important for a writer, is even if we have to postpone our large projects, our minds and lives aren't ready for it, there's always something we can do to keep our spark there that pays off later
on. I completely believe that the unconscious and the creative source, the muse, whatever you want to call it, are, whether we know it or not, in constant communication. And it's churning and incubating. So I have faith that when I go back to this novel, it's going to be very different and it's going to come together.
Good. I think that it will. Yeah. All you have to do is reread your own words in your book and you'll be doing fine. So again, I want to thank you so much for being with us today and for sharing your history with writing and your way of helping other people, whether they write or paint or dance, with what it means to be a creative person in this world. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.